Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been a pleasure, though from afar, to admire the man who we have the privilege of having as our first guest in this war for the free world. There are a few people who I think have comported himself with more distinction and done more to help the rest of us understand what we're up against than Bernard Kerik. He rose through the ranks of the New York Police Department to become its 40th commissioner. He was on duty when 9/11 went down and really was instrumental in helping what we came to call America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, in pulling his city through that terrible moment and helping, as I say, the rest of us, well, at least try to learn the lessons that we should have from it. He has gone on to become a national security advisor to King Abdullah of Jordan and the president of the Republic of Guyana. He is now the author of an important new novel based on his experiences, Grave Above the Grave. Bernard Kerik, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us. It's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, tell us a little bit about the novel, if you would, and some of the insights that you've put into that fictional account of what seemed to be pretty much your own experiences.
Well, listen, I was the New York City Police Commissioner during 9/11, and what a lot of people don't know is I actually worked in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for close to 4 years. And I worked for the King of Jordan for close to five. And during that time, between my time, counterterrorism measures here and there abroad, I have some pretty unique insight as far as who the enemy is, where they come from, and what we should be doing to stop them from, you know, creating more problems for us in this country. So I put that into a novel with a present-day fictional New York City police commissioner. And I've outlined a series of attacks that I believe we could be susceptible to if we don't pay attention to what we're doing and we let the wrong people into this country. And I think your listeners would find it interesting because it's, you know, it's riveting. It's sort of ripped right out of the headlines of today. But it's realistic in the sense that living in my head, knowing what I know, I've outlined a series of events that I think we have to be careful to watch for.
And I take it that you feel that we are not being careful as we should be, not least as I understand you shared with another radio host, Michael Savage, recently, that in fact, the left in this country seems determined to exacerbate many of these problems arising from what I think of as Sharia supremacism, the sort of jihadist doctrine that has afflicted us again and again and again and is operating, it seems, not just in the violent domain, but in sort of the subversive, stealthy one as well. Walk us through how that fits into the narrative of the novel and more broadly your thinking on the subject.
You know what, Frank? I think, look, we've come a long way when it comes to, you know, our intelligence capabilities, for example. We're far better than we were on September 10th of 2001, you know, communicating between local, state, and federal authorities. New York City has a benefit that most people don't know, and that is we actually have New York City cops assigned to international outposts in Asia, the Middle East, and in Europe to make sure we get those intel grabs first. But here's my problem with what's going on today, and you could say it's the left, you could say it's the Democratic Party. I don't know. I feel it's almost the Socialist Party at the route we're going. But we have members of Congress that they're emboldening and encouraging people to flood the borders. They want open borders. They're emboldening and encouraging people to register to vote in some communities, giving them voter rights when they're not even in this country illegally. And look, nobody knows and understands what happens when the wrong people are allowed to come into this country than I do. I've lived through it in a really bad way. And I just think it's bizarre that we have members of Congress, senators, governors, mayors, that they don't give a damn about our laws. They don't care what's right for our national security. They're encouraging people to come into the country illegally and then doing everything in their power to subvert our law, laws that are already on the books.
Yeah. Let me ask you in that regard, because, of course, you've had firsthand experience with law enforcement in the largest city in the country and the one that is arguably the most targeted of all. What does it mean as a law enforcement professional, Bernard Garrett, that you have, as you say, mayors and in some cases even governors essentially saying, wait a minute, these are sanctuaries for people who are here illegally? Is that serving as both a magnet for more to come and also as essentially a safe harbor for them to engage in activities against us, whether it's violent or simply subversive? Both are problematic.
Yeah, Frank. Yeah, but it's both. It's safe harbor. It's encouraging them to come, but it's even worse. And the worst part of it is these mayors and governors that are encouraging this stuff, they know that they're violating federal law. And my problem with Washington right now is nobody's taken any action against them. You know, when ICE puts a federal detainer on an inmate and says, we want to know when this guy's getting out of a county lockup or a state prison, and that government, the state government or the county government, turns around and says, we're going to ignore that detainer, that's a violation of the law. Why aren't they held accountable? It makes me crazy.
Yeah, it makes a lot of us crazy, I have to say. And I guess the best answer is that to the extent that the president has wanted to do this, he seems to be at the very least hampered, if not actually stopped, by judges on the one hand and, you know, members of Congress and the like. And I did want to just pick up on one of your points here. One of our colleagues, Trevor Loudon, has done a wonderful job of documenting the deep association of many members of Congress and others who are in public office with the Democratic Socialists of America, with the Communist Party, with the Muslim Brotherhood and the like. And it really raises the question of how can we possibly countenance such people in political office if they are that much at odds with our national security requirements and public safety.
What scares me is, everything you're saying is true, and that the American people seem to elect and re-elect these guys, even after they come out of their shadows. And, you know, you see how far to the left they go.
Bernard Garrett, we have to leave it at that, but we hope we'll have a chance to talk with you more about it in the very near future. Thank you for your time today. Next up, Rudyard Charles joins us right after that.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we are joined once again by a former Assistant Secretary of State, Robert Charles. You frequently see him at Fox News. He is a lawyer by training, an author of a new very compelling book, Eagles and Evergreens, and a man that we turn to with regularity for his expertise on a whole host of issues involving our national security, immigration policies, narcotics trafficking, and much, much more. You, as an attorney, as well as a man with long experience in the U.S. government, both in the White House and at the State Department, have an appreciation, I know, for what's going on at the moment with respect to Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee to become the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And Robert Charles, I just would ask, it seems to me that this has entered into the realm of political warfare, not just trying to tease out the, you know, personal history of the nominee, but really to take him out and to do it in a manner that is, I think, really problematic for the Senate as well as for the country. But your thoughts?
No, I completely agree with you, Frank. I think, sadly, we have politicized the process, which incidentally then in turn sort of indirectly politicizes the court, no matter how this comes out. We've politicized a process that always had dignity, procedure, and rule of law as its centerpiece. And instead, we've really defaulted to rule by emotion, which I find destructive tactically and strategically over time. Whether you're on the left or the right, it's a destructive way to manage government and things of this nature. You know, my gut on this is that unless something dramatic comes out that hadn't come out yet, I think it's a real red herring. It's intended. I mean, first of all, you have to ask questions in sequence. Why was this person seeking anonymity when they first wrote a letter? Then why did Feinstein, a senator, United States Senate, after a circus of a hearing with Senators Booker and Harris, really, in a sense, not living up to, in my opinion, what a senator should do? They really brought the dignity of the institution down with their antics and sort of circus act. And now we end up with Feinstein, you know, releasing long after hearing, which she had the whole hearing. And one has to transparently ask the question, because this is what occurs to everybody, isn't it really just a giant delaying tactic so that after the midterms, if you think you can force their hand, you prevent Kavanaugh or any other conservative from being appointed to the court? You know, my view on this is that jurisdictionally, this is not, even the allegation of it, something that happened in his teenage years, is not an FBI matter. It's a state level matter. It's not a federal statute involved here. So the idea of an FBI investigation is another red herring. It's, again, intended, it seems to me, to delay things. And the two attorneys, I mean, I don't know anything about the politics much of this accuser, other than that she was an anti-Trump person. But the politics of these two attorneys that represent her are very clearly anti-Trump, and you know, they're playing a very disruptive and, in my view, undignified and sad game, which is in a sense tormenting a process and a person, which is typically very professional. My view on this is that what should happen, and I ran an oversight committee for 5 years, what I think should have happened and should happen, is that you suspend the 5-minute rule, you get an agreement on both sides that you will do a proper direct examination. This person gets to come with their attorney in a closed hearing and present whatever is their formal complaint, which they didn't bring 35 years ago. There's no record of, there's no corroboration of, and there's denial of on the part of not just Kavanaugh, but others. But bring the direct accusation with an attorney at your side, and then be subject to half an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, if it needs be, cross-examination behind closed doors with all the members present, anyone who wants to be present. And then let the senators vote afterwards internally, just like disbanding into a committee of the whole. Let them assess whether they believe these are credible. If they are credible allegations, if there is unknown corroboration, if there is something meat on the bone that should be heard, then put it in the public sphere and have a cross-examination in the public sphere, a direct and cross in the public sphere. Otherwise, what you've done is you've taken a process which is procedural. And we rule, these rules exist for a reason. We have a process by which you, during the committee structure, bring things to bear, and someone has a right to respond to them. This to me just seems, it seems like warfare against Donald Trump through a surrogate. And it seems to me very sad.
Very damaging.
Everyone should evaluate this from the point of view of, if Mr. Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh, a distinguished federal judge, was your brother, your father, your son, and these things were lofted at him, how would you feel? I think on the flip side, you know, if this accuser were your daughter, your mother, your sister, what right should she have to bring her complaint? She should have brought it long ago if there was anything valid to it. But even if this is late in coming, to what degree do you subject a nominee to this circus? I think what you have to do is, behind closed doors, get at the truth. And I will guarantee you this: cross-examination of this woman. What were you doing there? What was your, were you drinking? Where was it? What time was it? What place was it? What year was it? How do we know that this isn't a creation out of whole cloth? You know, people do things. I know people say, well, no one would bring this up without a basis. But in truth, people do things for attention these days. And I'm just saying, you have to get at this behind closed doors.
I think that's not going to happen. It sounds like it will be in front of open doors. But I guess it remains to be seen who's going to be doing the cross-examination and the like. There have also, we just need to note in the interest of completeness, as of this moment, been other allegations raised, including from his time at Yale, and even Stormy Daniels' lawyer has now trotted out some charges. It raises this question again of a kind of campaign of political warfare, to my mind. It remains to be seen whether there's any facts to back up any of these. Let me ask you, finally, I woke this morning, Robert Charles, to interview on National Public Radio with a woman by the name of Usra Zeya, an Indian-American former diplomat now working for the leftist Center for American Progress, who has seen fit at this moment to come out denouncing your old department under President Trump for not being sufficiently attentive to diversity, LGBT issues, women in the diplomatic corps, and the like, accusing particularly under Rex Tillerson, the previous Secretary of State, a combination of incompetence, indifference, and bias to render the department less effective than it should be. I just would ask you, as a former senior official of that department, be it under the administration of George W. Bush, your thoughts when you hear these sorts of charges leveled, and more to the point, might this be another example of political warfare against this president? What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think, again, I actually heard that interview, Frank, and I went back and tried to figure out who she was, because I'd never, in my memory at least, bumped into her. You know, let me start out from the broad brush, and that is that the State Department is filled with true professionals. They really are professionals there. They speak multiple languages. They have a history of diplomacy. But they all work for the President of the United States, and in first instance, they work for a Secretary of State. And you know, again, like Rod Rosenstein, if you disagree with the policies of a president, and even though you're sworn to uphold the Constitution and he's the constitutional officer that you duly elected that you work for, if you cannot do that, then you actually should just resign. That is the option for you. And apparently, you know, I was looking back at her record, and she's a distinguished diplomat. Don't get me wrong. She served as a principal deputy in the Human Rights Division. Of course, that's that Bureau, Democracy and Human Rights. They probably were where a lot of money is going to be cut from, because there's a sense that the development money wasn't being tied to a national security or national strategy that aligned with trying to get both allies and adversaries lined up appropriately with that money. It was just sort of being spread like birdseed. And so to some degree, maybe that was a reason she left and has a degree of animosity toward this administration. I went back, though, and looked at when she left, and she left in April of 2018, I believe. And that's the exact moment when a report was issued by that bureau that came under attack from the left. And basically, the Trump administration reversed itself and went back, or reversed the Obama rulings in that report and went back to the period of the Bush years with a lot of the language in the report. So, for example, instead of, quote unquote, guaranteeing reproductive rights around the world, including a, quote, right to the access to abortion, which appeared in that report for the first time in 2012, they went back to the language that originally existed, which was against forced abortion and against sterilization. Another indication in that report, which obviously she had probably objected to, which is probably why she left. I mean, again, a distinguished diplomat, but she had her obvious personal views, and they came out in that interview, was they changed the language from the Obama administration had said Israel and occupied territories. In referring to Israel, they referred to it in the new report, the Trump report, as Israel, the Golan Heights, West Bank, and Gaza, which are geographic reference rather than politically charged reference. And so I think what happens is there's a natural course here, and she's part of it. When an administration comes in, and this happened during the Obama era in different departments as well, when an administration comes in and someone, it grates for whatever reason against their personal agenda, you have a choice. You either say, my personal agenda is subsumed to my professional obligations, and I am going to work for the president because he is the president, and I'm going to work for Secretary Pompeo in this case because he's the secretary, and I'm going to do my level best to perform my constitutional duties. And if, or you can go the other direction and say, look, I disagree with this personally. It roils me on an emotional level or whatever, and I'm deciding I'm not going to stay here any longer, which is apparently what she did. So, you know, in a sense, what I fault her for is saying that the department is either not representative. You select professionals to a professional job based on the professional credentials. And I think, you know, that's what this administration is doing. And perhaps that's what prior ones tried to do. But in the end, it isn't about what your tags are. It isn't about what your group identity is. You don't conduct foreign diplomacy by group identity or by identity politics. You conduct it with a professional sort of long pole in the tent.
I am afraid we are hard out of time, Robert. There will be, I hope, an opportunity to visit with you further about this and so much more, but I appreciate your time today.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined once again, as we are each week, by Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia. And in particular, what is happening there that should matter to all of us? Gordon is, of course, the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He's also a columnist for The Daily Beast, which he had just this morning an important post about what the upshot of the summit that took place between the leaders of North and South Korea last week might mean, not just for the upcoming conversations between Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, and President Trump, but for all of us as well. Gordon Chang, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you, Frank.
So there is this UN General Assembly meeting taking place in the next few days in which President Trump will be playing a prominent role. One of the meetings that he will be having in the course of all of that, among a number of other bilaterals, will be with this President Moon of South Korea. You've intimated in your piece in the Daily Beast that Moon is almost there as a proxy for the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un. How can that be? And what does it portend for an important alliance relationship between the U.S. and South Korea?
Yeah, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is probably Kim Jong-un's most effective representative. And the reason is that Moon is very pro-North Korean in attitudes in any event, but also that his main goal is unification of the two Koreas. And he's willing to do that more or less on North Korea's terms. For decades, the Kim family has had a proposal of a federated Korea. In other words, one country with two governments, one in Seoul, the other in Pyongyang. And this is a way station to what the Kim family thinks is the eventual domination of the entire peninsula by Pyongyang. Moon is very anti-American, deeply anti-American, and clearly wants the U.S. forces off the peninsula. He's hired so many leftist pro-North Koreans. And so, therefore, we've got to be concerned that we're dealing with two Koreans who are conspiring not only against President Trump, but also, of course, against the international community.
Mm. This is, needless to say, troubling, to say the least. We're watching essentially an alignment of South Korea's policies with pretty much those of North Korea, are we not? The North Koreans want unification. The North Koreans want U.S. forces off the peninsula. The North Koreans want to basically be dominant in terms of South Korea. And that all seems to be okay with the South. Presumably, at least with the president of the South Korean Republic, if not with President Trump, it may be something that is being done despite him. And I wanted to get some of the specific products of this summit between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un out on the table here, Gordon. You mentioned in your article at the Daily Beast this Pyongyang declaration. What's in it, and what does it, again, portend for the conversation with the president this week?
The Pyongyang declaration is one of the two documents that was signed between Moon and Kim. And the declaration really goes to this issue of the relationship between the North and South, the other document being a military agreement. The Pyongyang declaration is not very specific. What it talks about is inter-Korean development projects, such as the Kaesong Industrial Complex, also the Mount Kumgang tourist zone. Both of these were shuttered in previous years. And they also talk about the establishment of two new economic development zones. Also, in Pyongyang declaration, Kim Jong-un talks about the shuttering of a couple things. One of them is their missile testing site, which he previously promised President Trump, and also the closing of the Yongbin nuclear complex. This closing of Yongbin is the most important part of the document, at least with regard to our efforts to get North Korea to disarm and give up its weapons programs.
But am I wrong, Gordon, that that's been promised before? In fact, it's been done before under previous deals with the West, only to be undone when it suits the North Koreans?
Well, certainly. North Korea has promised to give up its weapons so many times in the past, and specifically it's promised to close Yongbin. This was part of the six-party talks that occurred between the Kim family and the administration of George W. Bush. And North Korea even got to the point of destroying a cooling tower there in a symbolic but not very meaningful move. In this particular case, in the Pyongyang declaration signed last week, we had North Korea say, well, look, yeah, they'll close Yongbin, but they want corresponding measures, quote-unquote, from President Trump. And they don't specify what those corresponding measures are, which is a real indication that Kim is serious only about procrastination. I think this is another one of his stalling tactics.
But what this joint declaration suggests is that the South Korean government is fine with this conditional arrangement, and the conditions being that the United States has to satisfy North Korea, right?
Absolutely, Frank. There is a fundamental disagreement between the United States and North Korea as to how to proceed. The North Koreans take the view that if they do something, a small step, then we take a small step. And this is step by step, as it's called. The United States position under the Trump administration has been, look, North Korea gives up its nuclear weapons, and then we then get go to the UN and take down the sanctions. We then establish relations. We have economic aid, all the rest of it, security guarantees. And clearly there is Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, says, look, I'm siding with the North Koreans on this. And Moon is basically saying, as he did in his press conference last Thursday after he returned from Pyongyang, Moon said, look, the ball is in President Trump's court. Well, no, it isn't. The ball is still in the North Korea's court. But clearly we're dealing not only with Kim as an adversary, but also Moon.
Yeah, being undermined by our so-called ally. Gordon, and just one thing on quickly on the these so-called economic zones. What's the history of those been to this point? Have they in fact produced the kinds of changes that we have been told they would in North Korea, or simply wound up essentially propping up the existing regime unchanged and in some cases engaging in even more dangerous behavior?
Well, it's the latter, unfortunately. The most important example is the Kaesong Industrial Complex. When it was going, it was shoveling somewhere between $90 and $110 million a year into the coffers of the Kim regime. There were about 125 South Korean light manufacturing operations there. And unfortunately, it had no effect on society in North Korea. So what we were really doing was just putting money into the hands of Kim, who was then using it for all sorts of purposes like nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles.
And the people who were working in those plants from North Korea, what were the conditions under which they were performing this work? Did it amount to essentially slave labor and uncompensated because the money was all going to the regime?
Most of the money did go to the regime because wages were paid in dollars. Workers were not allowed to keep the dollars. And what they got back was North Korean won. Also, they did get, and this is, in terms of social change, the only change really was that the workers got choco pies. And they almost became a form of currency in the southern part of North Korea. They really liked them a lot. But that was the extent of social change.
Choco pies? Is that what you said?
Choco pies. Yep. I'll be happy to give you one, Frank, next time I see you.
Terrific.
You can spend it in North Korea next time you go.
I'm a rich man in North Korea. Gordon, very quickly, just one other element of this summit, and again, with portentous implications, it seems to me, for our forces on the ground in South Korea, as well as our interest there more generally, was this 17-page military agreement between the North and South Korean leaders. What was in that? And again, what is the takeaway?
Yeah, there were a number of items in there. One of them was the enlargement, a substantial enlargement of no-fly zones over the demilitarized zone and their sea borders. The concern here is that we are not going to be able to surveil North Korea as we need to in terms of preventing an invasion or incursions from the North. Of course, the North is not able to do it as well, but unfortunately, they're not going to adhere to this military agreement as they have not adhered to all the other prior military agreements that we've had with Pyongyang. So I'm afraid that South Korea is not going to enforce it. And we got to remember that this is occurring at the same time that the Moon administration wants to substantially reduce the size of South Korea's army, as well as reduce the period of conscription. This is going to substantially erode the South's ability to defend itself, which I think very well may be the point on the part of Moon Jae-in, that he doesn't really want to have an effective deterrent. I don't know that, but you look at what he's doing, and that is one possible conclusion.
At the very least, it is weakening the defenses of our ally, and that has implications, of course, again, for the people of South Korea, but also for our substantial number of forces on the ground there as well. Gordon, you have a recommendation for President Trump as to what he should do in response to all of this, specifically in response to a letter that has been received by him from Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Just briefly, what would you recommend?
Moon Jae-in saying he's carrying a private message from Kim to Trump, and Trump at a rally on Friday said that he'd already received a letter from Kim.
A beautiful letter.
A beautiful letter, as Trump put it. We've been receiving a lot of these letters from Kim. My recommendation is that Trump, when he met Moon, I wanted him to send a letter to Kim through Moon. And that letter would be basically, look, no more summits, no more stalling, no more sleights of hand, no more subterfuge.
Gordon, there is so much more to talk about. I thank you so much for walking us through this incredibly important and dynamic set of developments on the Korean Peninsula.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are delighted to have with us, I believe for the first time, Benedict Rogers. He is a human rights activist who has specialized in Asia. His principal affiliation at the moment is with Christian Solidarity Worldwide. He is the author of 5 books, including Burma, A Nation at the Crossroads. He is a very considerable contributor to, among other places, the Catholic Herald, and wrote recently there 2 pieces that caught my eye that are very much top of mind for those of us worried about the persecution of Christians, namely a deal that Pope Francis has recently inked with the communist government of China that has to do principally, I guess, with the decision-making authority concerning the nomination of Catholic bishops in that country. But its implications are much more far-reaching. And to explore those, I'm very pleased to ask Benedict Rogers to shed some light on what the Pope is up to and its implications. Benedict, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Very good to be with you.
So tell us about this deal that the Pope has just signed. It's been a matter of very great controversy for, well, years, if not decades, as I understand it. What has he decided to do?
That's correct. It's been a long time coming. What has been announced is a deal, which I'm told by senior people in the Vatican is provisional. If it doesn't work, they say it will be reviewed. But the deal is that, as I understand it, the Chinese Communist Party will have a hand in nominating candidates to be bishops. The Pope will have the final approval of those nominations, and therefore, at least in theory, a veto. And it's an effort really to try to bridge the impasse that has existed for decades, well, effectively since the 1950s, where in China there have been two parts to the Catholic Church, the underground Catholic Church, which has been in full communion with Rome, and then a so-called Catholic Church that is under the control of the state, not in communion with Rome, and therefore not really a Catholic Church.
Essentially, the official church that's blessed by the Communist Party, which is an atheistic operation, last time I checked.
Exactly right. That's right. And so now you'll have an atheist regime nominating bishops for approval by the Pope.
And it's more than that, isn't it, really, Benedict? It's a regime that views Christians, and for that matter, people of other faiths, as a menace to the Communist Party and its absolute control of the people of China, and is confronting the fact that lots of Chinese are, in fact, converting to Christianity, as I understand it. What steps has the Communist Party of China been taking to counter, not just to dictate who's going to run the church in China, but actually to counter the presence of the church there?
Yes. Well, the timing of this agreement is particularly concerning because China is right now severely intensifying what many would say is the worst crackdown on Christianity and indeed on religion generally, really since the Cultural Revolution. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party has always, as you've described, been hostile to Christianity. But there have been periods over the last couple of decades, particularly, where it looked like there was a little bit of relaxation in the policy towards religious freedom, at least in some parts of the country. That is definitely not the case now. We've seen in the last couple of years the destruction of thousands of crosses, the dynamiting of church buildings, new regulations that prohibit children from attending church services, just recently, just I think last week, new regulations on religious activity online, which effectively will prohibit any sharing of religious material online. So it's an extremely severe crackdown.
And in addition, as I understand it, and again, our guest is Benedict Rogers, we're calling him in the United Kingdom, where he works with Christian Solidarity Worldwide, you have significant numbers of priests or other Christian religious leaders incarcerated in the Chinese gulag, and still others who have had the temerity to represent them and other Christians, human rights lawyers specifically, who have simply disappeared altogether. How serious a threat is the Christian community under at the moment in terms of its physical safety, not simply its practice of its faith?
Well, it's under certainly serious threat. As you say, there are clergy and lay people, both Catholic and Protestant, in prison. And you reference the crackdown on those who defend them, and you're exactly right. 3 years ago, there was an enormous crackdown that led to the arrest and actually disappearance of at least 300 human rights lawyers and their associates and families who were involved in defending religious freedom. And some of those lawyers have been released and have essentially left their legal work because of fear. And some of them remain disappeared. I mean, Gao Jisheng, the most famous Chinese lawyer, his whereabouts are still unknown, and he's been disappeared. China's actually made the word disappearance into a verb. They disappear people. And that's the threat, definitely, to Christians.
And again, this is the context in which the Pope has seen fit to recognize the authority of the Chinese Communist Party in terms of at least designating who the bishops for the Roman Catholic Church will be. This comes, as you pointed out in one of your pieces at the Catholic Herald, Benedict Rogers, on the 85th anniversary year of something called the Reichskonkordat. Remind us what that was and why this seems like such an inauspicious, well, reprise of such a deal with a totalitarian system.
Yes, well, the Reichskonkordat was reminded of this in an excellent article by George Weigel, the biographer of John Paul II, in the National Review in the United States. A very good man, absolutely. And he basically makes the argument that this agreement between the Vatican and Nazi Germany 85 years ago was very similar to what's just been agreed with China. That didn't turn out very well. And the Vatican appears not to have learned from history that totalitarian regimes cannot be trusted to honor their commitments. So even if the deal on paper looks reasonable, how can we expect a regime in China that behaves in many similar ways to the regime in Nazi Germany to honor what's just been agreed?
Yeah. Well, the honoring of it would be bad enough. The fact that they're almost certainly going to dishonor it is worse yet. And this notion that the Pope will simply tear it up if it doesn't work out, I think, is unlikely in the extreme, especially with this Pope. We have a few minutes left, and it won't be time to do justice to it, and I hope we can have you back to discuss it further, Benedict. But you've recently written an important piece about what's happening to Christians in Indonesia as well, another important Asian nation, and one that is, I'm afraid, increasingly, it seems, under the thrall of another totalitarian ideology, not communism, to be sure, but Sharia supremacism is the way I think of it. Tell us what's happening there briefly.
Yes, well, Indonesia has had until recent years actually a comparatively good record of tradition of religious pluralism. So it's the world's largest Muslim majority nation, but it wasn't an Islamic nation. It was a nation that recognized the rights of all the major religions. But in recent years, that's come under increasing threat, churches being forced to close, and particularly increasing incidents of terrorism. So my most recent piece focused on a visit I made to three churches in the city of Surabaya that were attacked within minutes of each other one Sunday morning by a family of suicide bombers who actually strapped explosives onto their own children, including an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old daughter, and sent them off into these churches. And it was absolutely horrific. And I visited the churches 3 months after this tragedy.
Mm. Well, again, this is a subject for a longer conversation, and I hope we can have it with you soon. Benedict Rogers, in the meantime, I appreciate what you do at Christian Solidarity Worldwide. Do come back to us again very soon, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.